So let's start. So we discussed about Krishna's beauty, strength and wisdom. Today we'll discuss about his wealth, fame and renunciation as much as we can. So we started with the, so regarding Krishna's wealth, there are different levels at which the concept of wealth can be understood. When at the grossest level, wealth is seen to be that which is measured in terms of currency or that which helps one to acquire gross goods. So now modern times, wealth is measured in terms of currency. Now, even from that perspective, Krishna is supremely wealthy. Krishna has the highest wealth in the sense that Lakshmi Sahasrastha Sambrama Sevyamanam. That how there are Shata is 100, Sahasra is 1000. So hundreds and thousands of Lakshmis are serving his lotus feet. So in that sense, he is supreme. But along with that, he is also supreme in the wealthy, in the sense that everything belongs to him. It's not just what we call as currency belongs to him, but also all resources, whether we value them or not, they all belong to Krishna. So actually Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says that everything is his energy. In other words, his 4th and 5th of the 7th chapter, he describes how the material world and the spiritual world are all his energies. So if everything is energy, Isha Vasam Idam Sarvam, the Ishopanishad reiterates the same thing in its first verse. So everything belongs to Ishvara. In that sense, he is the proprietor of everything. Hare Krishna. Pranjal Prabhu, I think your mic is... Hare Krishna. So, when we talk about Krishna's wealth, we can discuss it at these different levels. One level is that what we call as currency, Krishna possesses supremely. Another level is that everything that is there in the material world, it all belongs to Krishna. But there is an additional understanding of wealth also. So we'll discuss wealth at all these different levels. In our modern society, people think of wealth primarily in terms of currency or sometimes in terms of gold and jewels. Srila Prabhupada generally explains wealth in traditional culture in terms of crops and cows, grains and milk, because this is the staple food. This is ultimately what we need for living, is not just money or gold. What we need is food. An abundant quantity of food means prosperity. So, now when Krishna was there on this planet, at that time, the prosperity of Dwarka that is described was phenomenal. Now we read in the Mahabharata, we read in the Srimad Bhagavatam and several of the other Puranas also, like Vishnu Purana, Padma Purana, where either the sages come to meet Krishna or the Pandavas go to meet Krishna. At that time when they enter Dwarka, they are dazzled by its opulence. So we know Krishna made 16,108 palaces, one palace for each one of his queens. There have been many, many wealthy people in the history of the world. Just recently, one of the wealthiest persons in India, he made in Mumbai a huge house, a multi-story mansion, not just a mansion, it's a villa. And now he has entered the world records as the person with the biggest house in the whole world. And that is attracting wows from people. Such a big house. So, he is actually exhibiting his property and his prosperity by having such a big house. But the fact remains that even if in the material world a person possesses such a big house, the person cannot expand himself to enjoy the full house. He can be there only in one house at one time. And not only in one house, he can only be in one room of that house. Sometimes some wealthy people have many palaces. When Alexander tried to conquer the whole world, you know, he, whichever state he would conquer, he would take over the most opulent building, the palace of the king over there, and make that his own palace. But as he went forward to conquer, the people whom he had defeated, they regrouped and they attacked, and the warriors, the soldiers, the generals whom he had stationed at that particular palace, they would be overpowered, killed. And practically when Alexander came back, you know, Alexander came from Europe, from Greece onwards, he went through the Middle East, came to India. So as he was going forward, he was thinking that I am conquering the whole world. But when he went back, he found that everywhere where he thought he would be welcome back as a victorious general throughout the route which he had conquered, he found that everywhere there were enemies. Because whatever he had conquered had been reconquered by its earlier possessors. So, actually, as a victorious general, he could not even reach back to Greece. He just was killed on the way. In a skirmish, he was wounded and he died along the way. So, Srila Prabhupada would tell his disciples, don't make me like Alexander. That means that I have opened so many centers. You please maintain the centers. It shouldn't happen that when I come, that a big center opens up. And then when I go away, then nobody keeps coming, nobody comes over there, nobody maintains the center, and the center closes down. So of course, it is to the credit of the disciples of Srila Prabhupada that Prabhupada established 108 temples, and now devotees have expanded to more than 600 temples all over the world. But the point is, in this world, whenever somebody acquires a wealth, you know, he has to put in huge effort firstly to acquire the wealth. And even after acquiring that wealth, it is always very fickle. It can go away at any time from him. And that is what happened with Alexander. Now, there was another Muslim conqueror, Genghis Khan. You know, he came from Mongolia. And he went around conquering practically all of Europe. Now, from the Islamic point of view, he is considered to be one of the glorious rulers in Islamic history. But from the European history point of view, the Europe's population was cut down in two shocks. So one shock was the bubonic plague, which killed practically half of, one third of European population was killed at that time. And as it is described, when Genghis Khan went and conquered Europe, just by his conquest, one fourth of the population of Europe was killed. You know, he had a policy that whenever he would conquer a kingdom, he would not only spare the soldiers of the opponent army, even after soldiers would surrender, he would just behead them and kill them. Even all people, even ordinary citizens whom he suspected of conspiracy, he would kill them also. But his whole kingdom, which at one time extended from east of Mongolia to the heart of Europe, all the way up to France, you know, it just collapsed within 100 years of his departure. So now there is practically no kingdom. He's just a legend. And he's not a legend. He's a terror, basically. People don't even remember him positively. So the point again is that in this world, people struggle to acquire opulence, and they acquire opulence for some time, and then in no time it goes away. And even when it is there, because of the anxiety, they can't enjoy it. And not just the anxiety. Somebody says, I am the undisputed world number one. I am the world's richest person, and there's nobody coming close to me. Nobody can challenge me also. Still, because the person himself is limited, what he can enjoy is also limited. As I was telling, a person may build a big palace with 100 rooms in it, and he may have 100 palaces like this. But he can stay only in one room of one palace at one time. He cannot expand himself. So Lord Krishna, when he was staying in Vrindavan, you know, he apparently lived very simply. We will come to the wealth of Vrindavan at the end of the class. But when he came to Dwarka, he exhibited opulence that was unparalleled in world history. Now, he had so many thousands and thousands of queens, and he had a palace for each one of them. And you know, if an ordinary man marries so many women, or if he even has concubines, you know, he will first of all even forget which woman he has met and which woman he has to go and meet. You know, he'll have to have his own schedule to plan that. And if somebody has 16,000 wives, it will take him 5 years to spend one day with one wife. One wife will get his get to meet him only after 5 years. So it's a very pathetic situation for a materialistic person to try to imitate the Supreme Lord. But the Supreme Lord, when he was there in Dwarka, he would just expand himself, and he could simultaneously be with each queen. And this way, he fully satisfied all the queens, and he also, in this way, in an unparalleled way, enjoyed his opulences. Now, interestingly, when Narad Muni comes to Dwarka, he sees Krishna in different palaces doing different things at different times. So, not only does he see Krishna in different palaces at the same time, that means, you know, he just goes from one palace to another, and there is Krishna is regally enjoying with his sons and daughters in one family. You know, maybe he's thinking of their marriage. Another palace he's going, he sees Krishna is doing some religious ritualistic activities. Another palace he goes, Krishna is just honoring his food. So like that, he sees in different palaces, Krishna is at the same time there. But the Jiva Goswami explains in his Krishna Sandarbha that Krishna is not only there at the same times, Krishna is there at the same time at different times. Now what does that mean, at the same time at different times? This is actually an exhibition of the Achintya Shakti of Krishna. At the same time means Narad Muni is just going very fast from this palace to this palace to this palace. And he sees, oh, Krishna is here also, here also, here also. And there is no time for Krishna from rush from this palace to this palace. Krishna is eating food very relaxed. There is not that he ran from that palace and he was trying to evade Narad Muni and try to baffle him. So, he was at the same time at different palaces. But the important point which Jiva Goswami emphasizes is that he is actually at the same time in different palaces where the times are different. That means in one palace it is morning, another palace it is noon, another palace it is late noon, another palace it is evening, another palace it is late evening, another palace it is early dawn. So both time and space are controlled by Krishna, because of which he is truly the omnipotent and inconceivable Supreme Lord. And Krishna can enjoy all the opulences of this world. So even now, they just recently discovered the opulence of one temple in India. Padmanabhaswamy temple is also not a very big temple. So just the sheer scale of this opulence indicates what kind of opulence was there. Now, even if we accept the materialistic material view that this opulence came from a particular king. So currently they are saying that there are several kings in the South India, you know, there are Chola, Chela, Pandya. So one of those kings and maybe few of his ancestors donated this. Chandrasekhar, your mic is on, please switch it off. So, even if he donated the money, still how much jewelry could he have had, how much treasury could he have had to donate to everyone? And so in the Bhagavatam says, in the Mahabharata says, you know, the walls of the palaces of Dwarka were studded with jewels, and the desks were made of ivory, and that often many of the things were not just gold coated or gold plated, but they were made of the gold itself. Krishna would eat in jeweled vessels and golden vessels. This is no exaggeration. This is actually Krishna's natural opulence, and he accepted exhibited it in Dwarka. And so now, is Krishna still opulent? Now we may say, okay, there are temples which are still wealthy, but still not all Krishna's temples are wealthy, and not all of all of the projects that we are doing for Krishna's service have the same level of opulence, although we may also do better, we can do much more with wealth. Krishna possesses all opulence, but he gives the opulence to different people at different times. So, according to time, place, circumstance, depending on the karma of certain individuals, Krishna may let the wealth go to certain people. So, even in the Vedic times, there were times when Hiranyakashipu took over practically the wealth of the whole universe. And the Lord had to come as Vamandev, and he apparently begged from Bali Maharaj, another pastime. So the point is that the Lord has his own plan, and that's why sometimes it may appear as if he is wealthy, sometimes he may appear as if he is not wealthy. But the proof that nobody else is the possessor of the wealth is that they cannot hold on to it. Even if they want to, they cannot hold on to it. There are other people who are just trying to grab it. As yesterday I was talking with Giriraj Prabhu, who is the devotee surgeon who has operated me and is treating me. So he was telling that yesterday they had a very old lady, a 93-year-old lady from quite a wealthy family. She had a hip bone fracture and he had to operate her. So he, now normally in such old age situations, there is a great risk of the person dying during surgery. So the doctors have to take a written disclaimer, written guarantee from the patient and the patient's ward, the patient's guardian, whoever is accompanying, that you know that they are aware of the risk and they are doing the operation at their own risk, and they won't see the doctor. So this old lady, now she has several sons and daughters, but not one of them had come for the surgery. They had just sent the local maid servant who was looking after this lady, and this maid servant told the doctor, actually you are asking for a guarantee that this reassuring that we will try our best, but there is no guarantee the patient will survive. He says all the relatives want this patient to die so that they can take away all the wealth. So we have often heard about this, but it was quite graphic. In the operation theater, the relative's representative is telling the doctor that we want this patient to die. Why? Because others want to grab that wealth. So wealth in this world can be a source of great, great insecurity, misery, competition, hatred. So it is described that artha leads to anartha. So, at one level, in this world, physically, when people have wealth, it causes so much anxiety and hatred and misery. The Bhagavatam says that artha is the cause of all anartha. So, that was one level of wealth where Krishna possesses it in a incomparable and undisputed way. Incomparable, nobody ever had that much, and undisputed means, you know, Krishna never had to always be fearful and insecure of his wealth. Although there were opponents who attacked Krishna, Krishna just effortlessly defeated all of them. But this is only one level of wealth. In the 14th chapter of the Antilila of Chaitanya Charitamrita, that is entitled as Performance of the Vrindavan Pastimes. Performance of the Vrindavan Pastimes means that the 13th chapter was Rath Yatra, and this is Madhyalila, not Antilila. 13th chapter was so Rath Yatra, when Jagannath, who is actually Krishna, has come from Neelachal to Sundarachal, from Kurukshetra to Vrindavan. And when he is there in Vrindavan, at that time Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wants to hear the glories of Vrindavan. So Swarup Damodar Goswami starts speaking the glories of Vrindavan, and Srivas Thakur manifests the mood of Narad Muni. And he says, you know, what is so great about Vrindavan? Actually, there is some cow dung sprued everywhere, there are some cows, there is some forest, there are some thatched huts, and a few houses. He says, the real opulence is actually in Vaikuntha, where the goddess of fortune resides with all her consort, with the Supreme Lord, and thousands of servants serving them. So at that time, Sarvodhavadar Goswami refutes him. And he says, the wealth of Vrindavan is so great that even the dust particle of Vrindavan, the Vraja-Raja, as it is called, Raja is dust, and Vraja is Vrindavan, so Vraja-Raja. The Vraja-Raja, even one dust particle, is filled with nectar and is more valuable than all the wealth of Vaikuntha. And why is it more valuable? Because he talks at a deeper level. Yes, even in Vrindavan, whenever Krishna requires, they can manifest huge quantity of jewels and huge quantity of opulence. But that is not the point. The opulence of Vrindavan is the opulence of love. And there in that discussion, as well as in several other discussions, the main point that is brought about is how Lakshmi Devi, although she is the goddess of fortune, and generally the idea is that wealth can beget anything and everything. You know, if somebody is wealthy, then he can demand, I want to meet the Prime Minister, I want to meet the so-and-so film star, so-and-so movie star. So by wealth, a person can achieve anything and everything, generally speaking. But despite all her wealth, Lakshmi Devi is not able to enter Vrindavan entire Ras Leela. So in Bale 1, she stays outside and she's performing tapasya, by which she can actually get the credits to enter Vrindavan. So this indicates how glorious is Vrindavan, that even Lakshmi Devi cannot enter. Why? So the wealth she has, certainly she has the wealth of devotion also, but the wealth of Madhurya Bhakti, you know, of intimate devotion which the gopis have, that Lakshmi Devi doesn't have. And that's why she can't enter. So the wealth of Vrindavan is the wealth of Krishna's beauty and Krishna's bhakti. So Krishna manifests his beauty in an unparalleled way in Vrindavan, and his devotees manifest their bhakti in an unparalleled way in Vrindavan. So, you know, all over the world, devotees call Krishna's names, and the Vrajavasis call Krishna names. What is the difference? You know, all over the universe, the devotees call Krishna's name. Oh Krishna, oh Govinda, oh Gopala. And they beg for Krishna's mercy. But the Vrajavasis call Krishna names. They call Krishna names means, you know, there Yashoda Mai says, you're a chore. And the gopis say, you are a lumpet. Lumpet means, you know, you are a very unfaithful person. So that is the exalted nature of Vrindavan. Hare Krishna, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Okay. So, I was telling about how the world and the rest of the world call Krishna's names, and the Vrajavasis call Krishna names. They say, you are a lumpet, you are a chore, you are this, you are that. You know, actually all the Vrajavasis, according to their rasa, they call Krishna particular names. You know, Yashoda Mai and the elder gopis, they call, say, Krishna, you are a chore. You say, you are a chore and you have uncontrolled senses. And, you know, actually to directly say somebody that you don't have any control over, say, senses, it's quite a derisive thing. Similarly, the Sakya Ras, the gopas of Krishna, they call Krishna and they say, you are a coward. You know, you don't have any fighting spirit, you don't have any courage. Well, our game is going on, and just when it's reaching the peak, suddenly Mother Yashoda calls and you go away. You're afraid of losing and you take that as an excuse. And on the other hand, the gopis, they also call Krishna names. They say, Krishna, you are a lumpet. You are an unfaithful Casanova. You go to this this woman and that woman and you are never faithful to anyone. So actually when the Vajvasis call Krishna names, that gives the Krishna great happiness. Because that is love, which is untainted, which is unrestricted, unconstricted by knowledge of Krishna's opulence. So Krishna's Kavya reveals how Krishna says that the whole world loves me with Aishwarya. But Aishwarya Shithila Prem Na Kore Krita. He says that the love which is weakened by knowledge of Aishwarya does not please me. Rather, the love which is completely without any Aishwarya pleases me. So this is the love of Rajvasis, and that is their great wealth. On the other hand, there is Krishna's beauty also. Now if you see in Vrindavan, there are many sweet pastimes where Krishna manifests his wealth. So the gopis all have their jewels. And one day Krishna says that, you know, he went to the gopis and he said, I want some jewels. So the gopis say, why should we give our jewels to you? We'll not give. As it is, you steal our butter without by force. We are not going to give you the jewels. So Krishna is very sad. He says, okay, I'll make my own jewels. So he says to his mother that, oh mother, you know, you so give me some jewels. He said, I am going to grow a jewel tree, and on the jewel tree I will harvest a large quantity of jewels as fruit. Mother Isha starts laughing. And she says, oh, Khana, she thinks he's just a small boy. She says, jewels don't grow on trees like this. She says, no. You know, you sow mango, you sow fruit seeds, and the fruits grow. So like that, I will sow jewels as seeds, and they will grow. Give it to me. So ultimately, the heart of all the Vrajavasis is to please Krishna. So Ishwadamaya agrees. And then Krishna puts the jewels and he sows them, and the news spreads everywhere. If Krishna is sowing seeds of jewels, everybody starts laughing. The gopis say, you will grow jewels, let us see. So Krishna, he sows the jewels on the ground, and amazingly he does not water it, he milks it. You know, he gets his cows to milk the to put their milk on the places where he has sown the jewels. And within a few days, there a beautiful tree, the like of which is not seen anywhere else in Vrindavan, appears. And it grows, and everywhere there are jewels on that tree, and everybody is amazed. And Krishna decorates himself with many jewels. Krishna gives all the gopas jewels, and not only the gopas, even all the monkeys who are his friends, Krishna puts jewel garlands around the monkeys also. Krishna has his own sense of humor. And all these monkeys, just to add to Krishna's fun, they go to the houses of the gopis and they start playing in the trees. And the gopis look at the monkey and they look and look. And they say, how they got a... Now, just try to imagine this sight. A monkey playing around, hopping around in trees with a necklace of shining, sparkling jewels. Everybody is stunned. Where did these jewels come from? And everybody starts inquiring. And they come to know. But actually, it is Krishna has grown jewel trees. So, at that time, Krishna says, tells the gopis, you didn't give me jewels. I have made my own jewels, and I have more jewels than you. The gopis start thinking, what to do? And the gopis, they think, we will also grow jewel trees, and we will get also jewels. But they know that their elders will not allow them to take the jewels from their house. So what they do is, they go secretly to the treasuries of their houses and take out the jewels. And they sow the jewels under the ground. And after sowing the jewels under the ground,
They start watering it with high quality milk. They do exactly the same thing that Krishna has done. And then eventually, when the trees grow up, and they're eagerly waiting, when the jewels will come. 1 day passes, 2 days passes, 3 days passes. And as the tree grows, more and more time passes, all that comes out is simply thorns and brambles. And not a single jewel comes. And all the gopis are heartbroken. They're disappointed. And they're scared. They're disappointed because they did not have the jewels like Krishna had. And they're heartbroken because... they are frightened because when the family elders come to know that they have actually taken all the treasure and all the treasure is gone now, they will be in a lot of trouble. So they are wondering what to do. They are in great anxiety. So they approach Krishna and say, Krishna, please give me some jewels. So at that time Krishna laughed and said, why should I give you? He says, you never gave me jewels, so why should I give you? Just to add to the spice of the Leela, at that time the monkeys come there to play with Krishna, and Krishna immediately takes a jewel garland and puts it around the monkey's neck. So the gopis feel so mortified. You know, Krishna is giving jewels to monkeys, but not to us. So at that time, the gopis go back and they are in great anxiety. And then they meet in the forest and they are wondering what to do, how to deal with this great crisis now. So at that time, Krishna comes there. And for every one of the gopis, he has made a beautiful case with the name of each gopi written on it. And that case is filled with jewels. And he gifts it to every one of the gopis. So, of course, the story itself is there described by our acharyas. But the important point here is that wealth is at Krishna's disposal. Whenever Krishna wants, he has the Achinta Shakti by which he can practically draw out wealth from the earth. He can just make trees, and from the trees, jewels will grow out. Nobody else can do that. In general, Krishna and Vrindavan does not necessarily require the wealth, because Vrindavan is a simple village. But of course, in its simplicity, Vrindavan is not poor. As we know, there are Nanda Maharaj has 9 lakh cows, and they give so much milk and wealth in such profuse quantity, wealth in terms of the resources that they require. And we can get an indication of how wealthy Vrindavan was from the simple fact that Indra, who was the king of heavens, was also concerned about the yajna of Vrindavan. Now, from Indra's point of view, he is the god of heaven, and whether in one small village on this Marthya Loka and yajna is performed to him or not doesn't matter. No, of course, one thing that angered him was that he felt he had been disrespected, he had been slighted by the yajna not being done to him but to Govardhan. But another point was that even if he has been defied, why would he notice it also? He noticed it because Vrindavan was not a small place. Small in terms, because you say how it is, Devan bhavetanena te deva bhavayantuha parasparam bhavayanta shreya paramavapsita. In the 11th chapter of the eleventh verse of the 3rd chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna describes that the cycle of cosmic cooperation involves that we satisfy the devatas and the devatas satisfy us. So actually at a subtle level, the devatas get nourishment by the yajnas that we are performed, and we get nourishment by the profuse natural resources that are released by Mother Earth as per the sanction of the devatas and ultimately the super soul in the heart. So Indra was concerned because Vraja had so much wealth, and that's why the yajna that would be offered to him was at least in some small extent of consequence to him. It became of great consequence to him because it was his ego that was being challenged by the stoppage of the yajna. But still, Vraja was not just an obscure little village. It was a very prosperous and special village. So, this is the wealth of Vrindavan. And the wealth of Dwarka is Krishna has 16,108 palaces. The wealth of Vraja is that every dust particle is like Chintamani. And through this jewel pastime, it described it how even the dust of Vrindavan can produce jewels. Now Krishna personally does not value all this too much. Yes, he uses wealth for reciprocating love with his devotees. But for him, the wealth that counts the greatest is bhakti. And because that is the only wealth that will satisfy the heart, that will make one truly happy. So, Lord Krishna, you know, he treasures his devotees so much that for the sake of one devotee, you know, he is ready to sacrifice the whole world. We see when Draupadi was insulted, Krishna was ready to have a whole war just to have her restored to her dignity and to avenge those who had perpetrated that indignity against her. Krishna's wealth, the wealth that Krishna values and the wealth that devotees offer to Krishna is bhakti. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the last chapter of the Antilila Shikshashtakam, he describes at how, my dear Lord, Krishna Prema Bina Sabha Kangal, everybody without the wealth of Krishna Prema is Kangal, is poverty stricken. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is saying, my dear Lord, please accept me as your servant and as a salary you give me Krishna Prema. So the wealth of this world is temporary, the wealth of Krishna Bhakti is eternal. And Krishna exhibits both wealths as, so the spiritual wealth of bhakti is with Krishna and his devotees eternally. The wealth of this world comes and goes. And Kunti Maharani tells Lord Krishna that you are namo akinchana vittaya. You are the property of the impoverished. That means not that somebody has to be practically penniless, but one who has no attachment to the things of this world, you are the property of that person. Namo akinchana vittaya. And then Kunti Maharani, if we see her life, she was a royal lady. She was first the daughter of a king, then the husband of a king, then she was the mother of a king. But in spite of that, the wealth came to her, the wealth went away from her. And if we look at her whole life, it is quite tragic. In one sense, she was married, and then her husband, rather than enjoying the royal delights, had a reclusive nature and he went off to live in the forest. And she had to follow him and do all the austerities of living in the forest. And then suddenly, while they were just getting used to the austerities of the forest, her husband passed away and she became a widow. Now, in the Vedic culture or in general in any culture, now it is a very great, not just a disgrace and a stigma, but it's also a great distress and agony and heartbreak for a woman to live without her husband. So Kunti lost her husband, and then she had very gallant sons. You know, if a mother has a son who cannot do well, who is not very good at studies and who can't do well in the exam, she feels bad. But you know, if a mother has a brilliant son who can do outstandingly at the time of exams, but somehow or the other that son gets cheated at the time of the exams, and he is supposed to get very good marks, but because of some trickery, some scheming conspiracy done by others, now some other boy is made the topper, and this boy who is meant to, her son who is meant to be topper, is made into a failure. So that was what happened to Kunti. No, she had illustrious, virtuous sons, and they were meant to be, they deserved to be the rulers of the world, and by a wicked conspiracy, they were made into paupers. It was so heartbreaking for her. So in the first time when the Pandavas were exiled, at that time, or rather not exiled exactly, they went into the forest, Kunti went with them. That was when they were in Varanavarta and the palace of lakh was burned. So Kunti along with the Pandavas went into the forest. So at that time the five Pandavas along with their mother was there. And the second time when the Pandavas went, Kunti also wanted to come. But Yudhishthir said to Vidura that, you know, my mother has already become very old and she has already lived in the forest once. It's very difficult for her. So please, let her stay in your house. The sentence of exile is not for her. So then Kunti stayed with Vidura and Subhadra went with Krishna, Subhadra went to Dwarka, and Draupadi went with the Pandavas to the forest. So in both the cases they had one lady with them. You know, one lady is enough to protect. Lord Ramchandra had one lady and it was huge difficulty. So the point here is that she was first of all, she saw her sons, the Kunti saw her sons dispossessed, and then she was separated from her sons also. And then there was this very fierce, frightening war in which practically her sons could have died at any moment. So in one sense Kunti suffered so much. But Kunti is considered an incarnation of success potency of the Lord. Why success potency incarnation? Shakti Avesh, because she always held on to the wealth of devotion in the heart. So the real wealth is the wealth of the remembrance of Krishna. And the wealth of the remembrance of Krishna is what steadies and satisfies the heart. Steadies means the material attachments and material ups and downs, they make our heart agitated. And they make our heart unsteady and filled with worry. But the name of Krishna steadies our heart. Not only does it steady our heart, it satisfies our heart. That is the supreme wealth. And as devotees of Krishna, you know, we can look at various pastimes. You know, whenever Bhagavad Katha is there, one of the favorite pastimes that people like to hear is the Sudama Leela. You know, how Krishna had this poverty stricken friend, and Krishna and Sudama went to Krishna, and Krishna made him incredibly wealthy. And people think, yes, I'll also be a devotee of Krishna, and Krishna will also make me incredibly wealthy. So, and of course, there's another pastime of the fruit vendor. The fruit vendor offered a little to Krishna, just some fruits, and Krishna made her basket filled with jewels. So these are pastimes when Krishna gave great opulence to his devotees. At the same time, the same Srimad Bhagavatam, now there is also the pastime of Shrutadeva and Bahulash. Shrutadeva was a great king of Mathura, and Bahulash was a Brahmin of Mathura. And Shrutadeva was very poor, and Bahulash, the king, was wealthy. So Krishna went to the houses of both of them, and both of them sincerely and devotionally invited him, and Krishna received their hospitality. But it is not described that after Krishna departed, Shrutadeva became very wealthy. Shrutadeva became fabulously wealthy, like Bahulash or more than Bahulash. So Krishna benedicted Sudama, but he did not benedict Shrutadeva. Is it like that? No. Actually, Krishna, through his pastimes, teaches principles. So the details of the pastimes may or may not be replicable, but the principles are always replicable and repeatable. So Sudama did not go to the Lord for money. And the Lord did not, as an act of kindness, tell Sudama, yes, I am giving you so much money. The Lord did it because Sudama needed it. And Sudama needed it, and the Lord felt by his goodwill that, yes, Sudama deserves it. So he demonstrates how his devotee can be made materially opulent. But it describes Sudama was never attached to the wealth, and he was still attached to Krishna. Shrutadev, you know, the Lord did not make him wealthy, but Shrutadev never compared. He was still satisfied with bhakti. So the point here is again that, you know, the devotees may be made extraordinarily opulent by the Lord, or the devotees may not be made opulent by the Lord. But this, when we are talking about being made opulent and not being made opulent, this is just external material wealth. But what the Lord surely enriches his devotees with is internal bhakti. And that satisfies far more than external wealth. And we see this in the life of Srila Prabhupada also. Srila Prabhupada had a reasonably well-to-do business, but for the sake of Krishna, you know, he was practically neglecting his business many times and just focusing on trying to preach. And eventually, when at one particular point he was in Jhansi and trying to preach, you know, his whole business collapsed and he was reduced to nothing. Not only was he reduced to nothing, he left his family members. Even his family members were blaming him, you're not doing your responsibilities. He went to America, he practically had nothing. You know, he was poverty stricken. That is a practical word that we can use for Prabhupada's situation. You know, Prabhupada took those 40 rupees with him, went to America, and when he came back from America to India, those 40 rupees were still there with him. And actually those 40 rupees were used by the rickshawala who took them from the Delhi airport at late night to the to Krishna Pandit's house in Delhi, where Chiplinwala Bagh, where Prabhupada used to stay earlier, and where Prabhupada took his disciples. So the 40 rupees were not even used by Prabhupada. But still, in the between, Prabhupada had several, when he came back in 1968, he had several temples already ready. And then he had 108 temples by the time he departed. So when Krishna wants, just in one stroke, Krishna can give wealth to his devotees. And we see that Srila Prabhupada has such an extraordinary desire to fulfill Bhaktivinoda Thakur's prediction of having an Adbhut Mandir in Mayapur. And Krishna just arranged that. He's now arranging that through Ambarish Prabhu. You know, Srila Prabhupada went to America, and we know that pastime. When they were in Detroit, Ambarish Prabhu came to receive Prabhupada. He was Alfred Ford at that time. And he opened the door for Prabhupada. And then the devotees told Prabhupada that this is the great grandson of Henry Ford. So was Prabhupada impressed? No, Prabhupada was not interested in impressing wealthy people to get money from them. The second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam describes that, you know, dhan durmatandhair, that those who are blinded by wealth, why should the saintly people, why should the renounced people flatter them so as to get some worldly favors? So Prabhupada had no desire to flatter anybody. Prabhupada could have tried to speak sweetly to him and get him so that he would give some donations. Prabhupada did not do that. Prabhupada just told him very calmly, but very penetratingly. He says, "You are the son of great grandson of Henry Ford. Where is he now?" So "where is he now" meant that he had so much wealth, but his wealth is left over here and he has gone somewhere else. So Ambarish Prabhu later on says, "When I heard that, I knew that I had met a saint." He was not concerned with pampering me to get my wealth. He was simply concerned with wanting to help me, elevate me, enlighten me. So Srila Prabhupada just gave one casual instruction to him. It was not even an instruction, it was just a casual talk. You know, one day Prabhupada was there talking with the devotees, and they are talking about the Vedic planetarium. At that time Ambarish Prabhu came there, and he also started hearing what the devotees are talking. And then Prabhupada turned to him. Prabhupada said, "No, so we are planning to make this planetarium." And when they heard it, he said, "Hey, how do you think about Prabhupada?" said. So he said, "It sounds like a good idea." So Prabhupada said, "Then you build it. Then you build it." And just a casual word, and he has taken it as his own life. And now by his diligence, the Mayapur temple is coming up quite fast. And the devotees are planning, working very, very hard, that for the 50th anniversary of the establishment of ISKCON, that is 2016, the planetarium temple should be ready. So when Krishna wants, he can give profuse amount of resources. But whatever he wants to make sure for a devotee is that the devotee does not take that wealth and go away from him. So as devotees, you know, we can also, Prabhupada told his disciples also, Krishna can give the whole world in 18 days, just like he gave to Arjuna in 18 days on the battlefield. But he said, "Are you ready for it?" So as devotees, if we become attracted to worldly resource and worldly wealth, then Krishna, as a loving father, does not want us to get distracted away from his bhakti. And so he may not give us the worldly resources. But if we stay fixed in his devotion, and if we show Krishna that, "Krishna, I am here to serve you, and whatever you offer me, I will serve you with that," then Krishna will offer more and more and more. Here also in Mumbai, you know, the devotees never really went around for fundraising. Just focused on having beautiful devotional standards and creating a wonderful devotee community. And then now in Thane, the devotees have got a huge property. You know, Thane is like a heart of Mumbai to some extent. And there they have got 6 acres of land. And there now His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj is planning to make a seminary. A seminary is a recognized affiliated college, university for training priests. So Christians have many seminaries, but Hindus till now don't have any seminaries, practically speaking. So they are planning to have it affiliated with some international universities and have some proper degrees. So they have got a magnificent land for that.
in the heart of Mumbai, and things are moving forward. And the person who gave that, he is himself very wealthy, but and he was just attracted by the devotional atmosphere, and he gave. Now at a material level, we can say, oh, that person is so kind, he has given so much money. Then when Srila Prabhupada was in Jaladuta, and when he was in Jaladuta, at that time, generally in ships, people eat non-vegetarian food, and that was the norm. But this Sumti Moraji had instructed Captain Pandya that actually this Bhaktivedanta Swami is a vegetarian. So please arrange for some vegetarian food for him. So Prabhupada writes in his Jaladuta diary that actually speaking, I am so grateful to Lord Krishna for having enlightened Sumti Moraji from within her heart to arrange for vegetarian food. So just see Prabhupada's depth of consciousness. You know, he is grateful to Sumti Moraji, and he writes that in several letters of his. But his gratitude is not just ending with Sumti Moraji. He's seeing that Krishna from within the heart is giving that inspiration to Sumti Moraji. So like that, Krishna from within the heart can give inspiration to many wealthy people to give whatever resources are necessary for Krishna's service. So as devotees, we focus on just trying to serve and please Krishna, and when we do that, Krishna will, his opulences are there, he can provide it any quantity that is necessary for his service. So I'll conclude with one verse, which is basically a meditation. What is this meditation? The meditation is that Krishna is Lakshmipati, but he is Gopal. You know, the gopis in this Gopi Gitam, they describe Pranat Dehina Papakarshanam Trunacharanugam Shriniketanam Panifanarpitam Te Padambhujam Krunakucheshuna Krindirakshayam. So they are glorifying the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, which they consider to be the greatest wealth. And they are saying, what is the nature of this lotus feet? They are saying, Pranat Dehinam Papakarshanam. That actually, in trying to acquire the wealth of this world, one makes so much pap. But in trying to acquire the wealth of the lotus feet of Krishna, Pranat Dehinam, one bows down to the lotus feet, Papakarshanam, all the sins get crushed away. But what are those lotus feet which can destroy sins? What are they doing? Trunachara nugam. Trunachara. Truna is grass. Chara is eat. So those who eat grass, that is the cows. So anugam. Anugam means to follow. So those lotus feet are following behind those who eat grass. So, you know, this is, that which eats grass is a relatively insignificant animal, a cow. And Krishna is following the cows. And just to emphasize this, the extraordinariness of this, they are saying that those same lotus feet are Shri Niketanam. Lakshmi Devi resides in those lotus feet. Niketan is home. So, those lotus feet which can destroy all sins, those lotus feet which are the abode of Lakshmi Devi, they are following after the cows. Panifanarpitam te padambujam. And what is the nature of those lotus feet? That actually the Kaliya serpent was so evil and demoniac. But just because he surrendered to Krishna, what happened? Krishna offered those lotus feet to Kaliya. Fani fana arpitam. Fani fana arpitam. Arpitam means he offered. Why? Now what was his qualification? No, his wives prayed to Krishna and he also prayed to Krishna. Krishna was just pleased by the simple prayers. So they are talking about this because, you know, by Krishna offering his lotus feet to Kaliya, Kaliya was freed from all sins. And Kaliya became a devotee. In the Kaliya pastime described in Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna tells Kaliya to go out of Vrindavan and never come back and disturb the Rajvasis. But in the Goswami literature, they reveal a pastime that happens in another yuga. And there it describes that Kaliya becomes a devotee carrier of Krishna. And whenever Krishna has to go in Vrindavan, Krishna sits on the hoods of Kaliya and Kaliya carries him around. Basically, the point is Kaliya's venom and envy goes away and he becomes a devotee. And so what are they concluding the prayer with? Krundiruchayam. And they're saying, please, dear Lord, please place those lotus feet on our heart. So actually the lotus feet of Krishna are the supreme wealth. And when they are placed in the heart, then a devotee becomes completely satisfied. So placing the lotus feet of Krishna in the heart means becoming attracted to Krishna. Making Krishna as the wealth of our lives. Making Krishna as the supreme goal of our lives. So Krishna Dhanna Prana. Tumi Krishna Mata Krishna Pita Krishna Dhanna Prana. So that is the mood which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also has taught us. So I'll summarize. We started by discussing about Krishna's wealth. At one level we discussed how Krishna not only owns all the wealth of this world, owned by Lakshmi Devi, but Krishna owns practically all the resources, whether people consider them as wealth or not. We consider wealth, currency as wealth. But everything that is there is owned by Krishna. And then we discussed Krishna's opulence as manifested in during his Dwarka Leela. So he had so many palaces and he could actually enjoy them fully because he could expand himself and be there and he never had any insecurity or fear. So Abhi contrasted that with the wealth of Alexander or with the wealth of some wealthy capitalist in this world. He cannot enjoy it at all. There is so much anxiety and he is so limited. He can stay only in one house at one time, in one room of one house at one time. Then we discuss about the wealth of Vrindavan and discuss the jewel story told by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in his Chamatkar Chandrika. And then we discuss how even the one particle of dust of Vrindavan is more wealthy than the wealth of Vaikuntha because it's permeated with bhakti. And as required, it can manifest jewels from the soil, practically speaking. And lastly, we concluded by discussing about how Krishna can give his devotees wealth whenever he wants. So he venerated Sudama, but apparently for the material level, he did not venerate Sudama, but he venerated Shrutadev. But he venerated both of them by giving them bhakti. And we discussed Prabhupada's life. And we conclude with the prayer from the Gopi Gita. So is there any one question? Yes, so it's an important question. When we pray, can we ask for material things? Praying is actually a process of sharing our heart. So, you know, we don't want to just pray to develop a business relationship with Krishna. That means that we don't want to, sometimes if you look at the Bhagavatam prayers, many times the prayers don't end with any demand at all, any request at all. It's just glorification. Like we have the prayers of the Brahma Samhita. Now the prayer that we sing is an extract, it's the fifth chapter of the Brahma Samhita, an extract from that. And from the beginning, Ishwara Paramakrishna, to the chorus, Govindamadi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami, to the last verse, Shriya Kanta Kanta. Now it's just glorification of Krishna's supreme position, contrasted with the subordinate position of everything and everyone else. And there is no asking anything for the Lord. So this is a redefinition of prayer for us. We see that just as Shravan Kirtanam is an Anga of Bhakti, Vandanam is also an Anga of Bhakti. And what is the purpose of the Angas of Bhakti? The purpose of all the Angas of Bhakti as described by Prahlad in the verse after the Shravanam Kirtanam verse. He describes, Iti Pum Sarpita Vishnu Bhaktis Chenana Valakshana Kriyeta Bhagavat Yadha Tanmanye Dittamuttamam. He says, these nine processes of Shravanam Kirtanam Smaranam, when applied to Vishnu, what happens to them? Then they become bhakti. They are the nine symptoms of bhakti. And what do they do by that? Kriyeta Bhagavat Yadha. They increase our attraction to Krishna. They help us develop our relationship with Krishna. So, for us, the purpose of all the limbs of bhakti is to develop our relationship with Krishna. The purpose of praying is also to develop a relationship with Krishna. So therefore, how do we develop a relationship with a person? By sharing our heart with that person. So if at our conditioned stage, in our heart, our material anxieties, our material worries, our material desires are taking a prominent place, if we try to keep that part of our heart separate from Krishna, then we are not really sharing our heart with Krishna. But if at the same time we let our material desires dominate our heart and we make our relationship with Krishna centered on the fulfillment of material desires, then that is just sakam bhakti. That is not proper devotional service. So therefore, if a devotee feels that a particular material thing is important for him, he can pray to Krishna for that material thing. And by that prayer, rather than making it conditional, he can make it unconditional. That means, my dear Lord, this is what I feel is the best for your service. My dear Lord, I know that it is your service only that is of truly of value. But in my current situation, I feel that this particular arrangement, if it is made, if this particular thing is provided, I can serve you better. And therefore, I pray to you for this particular thing. But ultimately, whatever is your will, I will accept that. So as devotees, we would like to get jobs in situations where we can have association of devotees. If you want to join or you want to settle down in life, if you have a job which give a good pay package, then you can finish off your financial dues quickly and then you can focus more on devotional service. So in that sense, certain material situations are congenial for devotional service. And if you are striving for them externally, there is no harm in praying for them internally. Because as it is, we are striving for them externally. So it is our desire. And Krishna can clearly see through our action that that is our desire. So why keep that disconnected from our relationship with Krishna? But we can make it dependent on Krishna's will by telling Krishna that this is what I feel is best for me. But if you have some other plan, please give me the intelligence to understand your plan and the determination to follow that plan. So we can offer prayers for material things, but just as we follow up our material prayers by vigorous action. If a devotee wants good marks in his studies, he studies nicely. So similarly, along with our prayers for material things, we should also pray for spiritual things, like improving our chanting, increasing our attraction for Bhagavatam, increasing our attraction for Vaishnavas. And we should show that also by our actions. We should follow up our prayers by our actions, by actually trying to chant nicely, by actually trying to develop a relationship with Bhagavatam and the Vaishnavas. So in this way, our focus of our relationship with Krishna is trying to develop a direct relationship with Krishna by developing a relationship with the limbs of bhakti. But along with that, we can also pray to Krishna for the material things that we need so that we can serve him properly. Okay? So we'll stop here. Thank you very much. Shri Krishna Bhagavan ki jai, Shri Prabhupada ki jai, Gaura Bhaktavinda ki jai.